Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. Hi everyone, thanks so much for joining us. Joining us today is Lisa Moan, the pediatric naturopath, and today we'll be discussing childhood anxiety, part one of a two-part series, and this one will be causes and drivers. Welcome to Natural Medicine Podcast, Lisa. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
An absolute pleasure, and thank you so much for your time. Now, let's go through a little bit of your career, because you've got an interesting career, but a very dedicated career to your patients. Can you take us a little bit through it, please?
Yeah. Well, I started off doing something very, very different. So I did start off as a mechanical engineer and then worked for about 15 years in the food industry. So really, you know, formulating foods, trying to like meet nutritional targets of foods. But then a while ago, I just decided that wasn't really what I needed to be spending my life doing. So I retrained as a nutritionist and a naturopath. And now I work primarily with kids. And my subspecialty is really kids with extreme fussy eating and then all the issues that go alongside it. So that's the majority of the clients that I see now are extreme fussy eaters.
Can I ask a little bit about that previous life?
Yeah.
A mechanical engineer, one would think grease, metal, no.
Yeah. It's fair to say I had no idea what mechanical engineering was when I signed up to do it. I was very good at maths and I think I thought I was doing industrial design. But yeah, it was all about choosing bearings and designing gearboxes. So I finished the degree, but it was certainly not the life that I was going to do.
But then there's the jump into food technology.
Yeah.
Again, that's...
So then I did a master's in food science as my kind of get out of engineering clause. I
just
straight into a master's of food science. So the two go together very nicely. So I worked for 15 years in food factories. So it was good. I understood how the equipment worked and how the food worked. So it tied very nicely together. So it was good. It was very interesting, very challenging, but very different to what I'm doing now.
Your work in the food industry, was that the eye-opener for you that says this is wrong, this is just way wrong? What was that like working in that industry?
Yeah, it made me realize how much of a minority I was in my beliefs and how I fed my children, because I never fed my children the foods that we made in those factories, like never, still would never. And it really made me realize that most people, even you think these days that people kind of know that giving your children sugary cereal for breakfast is not really the best idea, but no, the majority of people still think that's a totally reasonable thing to do.
Okay, so was that though the driver to say I have to get out of here as well, and what do I study? Nutrition, naturopathy, why not dietetics, for instance, why not more orthodox food approach?
I was brought up with I don't know if you know the textbook, is by Dr. Vogel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that was when we were growing up.
Nature doctor.
The nature doctor. That was the book that came out every dinner time. My dad was a vet. My mother was like an agriculturist. So we would sit down at dinner and we'd talk about different things and we'd go and grab Dr. Vogel and see what he would say about it. So my parents were very much into, you know, reflexology and all the stuff. You know, just herbs, nutrients, all of those things, even back there. So I was brought up like that. When I was 18, I was at university studying mechanical engineering and I got glandular fever just when I was finishing school. So I prescribed myself echinacea. As an 18-year-old mechanical engineering student, I took echinacea for like 6 or 9 months. I used to write to a homeopath in Scotland and he would write back to me and tell me what to do about different ailments. So no, I was always... Even though I was working in a very different world for my own personal health, I was always very much in the natural world.
Isn't it funny that echi means something different to a herbalist?
than a 20-year-old party goer.
Yeah.
Let's go into our topic today. It's a huge anxiety made worse by COVID-19 lockdown, which we seem to be suffering this mild PTSD. But take us through just how big an issue childhood anxiety is.
Yeah. So it's interesting. When I looked into actual statistics on it, the latest statistics I could find was 2017, when 1 in 14 children had a diagnosed anxiety disorder. So that's diagnosed, so as in they've actually been through the process. But between 2020 and 2022, there was a 36% increase in toddlers going to see psychologists. So now children as young as 18 months are being referred to psychologists for separation anxiety. And in the age group 18 months to 5 years, there's a 25% increase in generalized anxiety disorder just in those 2 years alone of the pandemic. Then in primary school and high school, the increases are much, much bigger, like 60% increases. Because it's really, lockdowns was just the perfect cocktail to provoke anxiety in children. Stay indoors all day, do all your schoolwork on your device, don't see any friends, don't get any vitamin D, don't get any nature time. It's like, if you wanted to create an anxiety like fueled environment,
smelting pot,
what you would do.
So what about the medical diagnosis? Where is anxiety a symptom of something greater, and where is anxiety the issue on its own?
So it does commonly co-occur with other conditions like autism spectrum disorder, ADHD, and then things like PAN, so pediatric acute onset neuropsychiatric syndrome. And then there's a condition of extreme fussy eating called ARFID, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And I think 60% of children with that disorder would meet the criteria to have an anxiety disorder as well. And then there's OCD, there's panic disorder, there's phobias, there's lots of different ways that it can present in children.
So let's talk about PANS and PANDAS just for a tick to sort of get that out of the way. Same with ARFID, we'll sort of get that out of the way so that we've done a differential diagnosis, if you like. Some of the hallmarks of PANDAS and PANS, what are we looking for?
So it's really where the anxiety just comes on overnight. So, you know, on the 25th of August, they were fine. 26th of August, they woke up and they had really bad separation anxiety, OCD, and a range of other symptoms. So usually it's a very acute onset over a day, a week, unless it's triggered by mold, where it can be a more gradual sort of onset. But that's, you know, I had a client yesterday and they said, yeah, there was no problems until she had tonsillitis and the next day she had OCD. So it's that really sudden onset.
Is there a different etiology from PANDAS to PANS?
Yes. So PANDAS is strep related. PANS can be any trigger.
Yeah, right.
Really. Can be a concussion, can be mold, can be a virus, can be COVID, glandular fever.
And so much more comprehensive and tortuous in its etiology and makeup and therefore treatment.
Yeah, and identification, because, you know, if people are just thinking of strep and strep antibodies, well, that's not going to be relevant.
Yeah, right. And then ARFID. Now, this was really interesting. You and I have spoken about this before, and I thought, oh, my God, I have never heard of this before. Can you take us through this briefly, please?
It's when a child's eating gets extremely restricted, and it's not related to body image. It's not because of, like, cultural practices within the home, or it's not to do with food shortage, and it's not to do with an underlying medical condition. So that's basically ARFID. So when a child gets an ARFID diagnosis, it's very disheartening because the parents are basically told this is just ARFID. Your child just doesn't eat. But when they've actually taken, you know, hundreds of children with an ARFID diagnosis and really drilled down into, is there an underlying issue like reflux, constipation, a parasite, something else? They find that in the majority of cases, there actually is. So ARFID is often kind of an early closing of the book and an early cessation of investigations. Whereas if you really keep looking and looking and looking for an underlying cause, often you will find one.
Okay. So ARFID is considered to be rare. Is that correct?
It's a new diagnosis. So it only came into the, you know, either the latest DSM or the one before. It wasn't there before that. So it's a newer diagnosis. So probably not, you know, it's catching up basically, but it's not that rare. And if you look on PubMed, if you just type ARFID into PubMed, it's overwhelming the amount of research that's there on it.
Right. I would actually expect that, because how many times in the health system do we feel let down by a lack of investigation, a lack of pursuing the diagnosis? Yeah. If it's not evident, that's it. It's ARFID, bang. So to me, it's a little bit of a scapegoat diagnosis. Yeah. And I understand, you know, how much do you invest in healthcare? How much do I get it? Totally. But these are kids that are labeled with something that may or may not be therefore successfully treated, because it's just put into a box. See you later.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm. Yeah. So tell us more about how patients find you then. Where along their journey do they come and see you?
Often they'll have been to see like occupational therapists or speech therapists for many years to work on feeding issues and really not made any progress over that time. And so when they've kind of exhausted the normal path that you go down, then they'll come to see me to sort of try a new approach, try something different. And you know, they might have heard that gut issues might be a problem, or they might realize that actually my child is constipated as well, and nobody has really addressed that. So I'm a bit of a last resort for some people, and when they've tried all the normal things first.
Isn't it sad that naturopaths are often the last point of call, where indeed they should be the first point of call, particularly when we're speaking to people like yourself who've just got such expertise in this area, such acute expertise. Lisa, I want to delve into the conditions that we're dealing with a little bit more. Causes of anxiety. Now, this is a piece of string, I get it. But can you take us through some of the major causes of anxiety?
So often there will be a trigger, you know, some sort of traumatic event or stress in the home, things like that. But obviously not everybody who's exposed to, you know, stress or traumatic events will develop anxiety. So then there's certainly genetic susceptibility. There's gut issues, so microbiome issues that will predispose you to develop anxiety. Heavy metals affect your neurotransmitters and how you process all that information. Nutrient deficiencies, so you know, having a zinc deficiency and then a copper excess will lead to anxiety. So it's intertwined with, you know, having a limited diet will absolutely predispose you to then developing an anxiety disorder for all of those reasons. Even artificial sweeteners have been linked to developing anxiety. So, you know, the kids who are drinking, you know, diet soft drinks because their parent thinks that it's better than giving them proper soft drinks, you know, all of those things compound to the development of anxiety.
How much do we weight physical antecedents to anxiety versus psychological antecedents to anxiety? The dynamics of the home environment, the dynamics of the school or interpersonal environments with the child. How much do we weight the psychology versus the physical?
Well, I think, you know, they're both important, but the normal path for a child with anxiety is to go to see a psychologist. That is what is done. If you take your child to GP, say they've got anxiety, they will write you a mental health plan and they will go to see a psychologist. Nobody will say, well, let's test your copper to zinc ratio. Let's, you know, do a stool test. Let's see what's going on in your gut. So obviously both are important, but both are not happening. Only the psychology angle is actually happening. And I think, you know, doctors and GPs, everybody knows that exercising more, eating a healthy diet, you know, doing all of getting better quality sleep, everybody knows that these things will reduce anxiety, but nobody has the time to sit with a parent and actually tease apart those issues and then coach the parent on how to address those issues.
Gotcha. Let's take everyone through let's say a first meeting with yourself, what sort of things do you assess? What sort of things do you question with the adult, with the child, with the parent, the child? Take us through what you talk about.
So generally, I won't even have the child there in the first appointment because I want the parents to be able to talk candidly about what's going on. And, you know, children take on everything that they hear. Even, you know, if you tell a child they're a fussy eater or they've got anxiety enough, then they'll identify with that. And they'll go to someone's house and they'll be offered food and say, no, I'm a fussy eater, so I don't eat that. So I like to talk to the parents alone. But we talk through everything. Like in a typical naturopathic consultation, we talk about, you know, pregnancy, birth, the early days. We talk about sleep hygiene. We talk about bowel movements, diet, school, everything. But what I'll do is with every single child, I will do testing. So yeah. it's not something that I'll do occasionally. It's something that I'll do 99% of the time, unless, you know, there's really strong reasons why the parent can't do that. So I'll do either some sort of gut testing, I'll do some DNA testing, or I'll do hair tissue mineral analysis. And often I'll do two of those right at the get-go, because that's how you get to the underlying cause. You know, that's how you find out what the problem is, why these issues have developed.
You two of them right from the get-go. So
yeah, two tests. Well, I'll say, right, we're going to do a stool test, we're going to do a hair test.
And I see.
In the first appointment. So then when they come back for their second appointment, we have all the information.
Gotcha. So tell us about that dynamic. You're speaking to the parent, the child's in the corner going, oh, get me out of here, this is boring. Obviously, there's going to be some interaction there, but you concentrate on building rapport with the parent first. Does the child get included there along the way and start to say, oh, you know, we can talk with you as well? Or do you work on rapport with the parent so the child feels at ease?
So unless it's a sort of 12, 13-year-old or above, the child isn't even there. The child's probably at school, because most of my work is via telehealth anyway. So I'll be on telehealth with the parent. The child won't even be there. So once they're like high school age, then it's different. I want to talk to the high schooler about everything and what's going on with them. But otherwise, yeah, the child's not even there.
Right. And then we've got, you know, diet, obviously. I guess one question I wanted to ask first before I forget more importantly is we've spoken about the gut. You speak about dysbiosis, and therefore we're speaking about the microbes. We're now seeing these psychobiotics enter the market. I've been told that one of them has some decent research, but previously I've been a little bit disappointed in that the psychobiotics on the market to date have been rated, if you like, with a very subjective rating scale, like sadness, things like that, rather than things like the HAM-A, the HAM-D, the Beck anxiety, Beck depression scale, or any of these approved anxiety rating scales. Where do you find the place of probiotics versus diet, and do you combine them?
So, you know, diet is something that's unchangeable initially for most of the children I see. So, you know, saying, right, we're going to address this through food and we're going to do a Mediterranean diet for 4 weeks and we're going to see how I feel. It's not possible. It's not going to happen. They don't eat fruit, veg, nuts, seeds, fish. So we can't do that. So you're left with, you know, supplements that have no taste, no flavor, and you can easily pop into the food that they're eating. So probiotics and prebiotics, perfect. So I will often start with the probiotics for mental health plus the prebiotics. And I've actually had great results even with the probiotic on its own. So it's been just that a single probiotic in some children has been amazing, just to shift them out of that sort of, just to calm them down basically, so we can move forward and start to work. It's been really good. Obviously, if the problem is that they've got mercury toxicity, probiotics not going to help. But if the problem is that they've had 15 courses of antibiotics in the last 2 years, then yeah, maybe the probiotic will help. So, you know, whenever these things are researched, they need to be researched with people who are going to benefit from it. So the probiotics will only help if the gut issues are the problem. But yeah, I've had great results with probiotics.
Salient point. Thank you for that. Because one of the things that disappoints me is when you see these meta-analyses and they say probiotics don't work. How many probiotics? That's like saying pain medication doesn't work because you're lumping paracetamol with oxycodone. So it's such a broad area where you need to be more specific in what you're choosing, right down to the strain, to say, well, does this strain work for antibiotic-associated diarrhea? Does that strain work for antibiotic-associated diarrhea? You can't meta-analyses different strains because they've got different actions. Take us through then how you start to weave in dietary changes in an anxious child, because I would imagine that an important factor for the child, particularly when you've got things like, say, constipation, is that aspect of control for the child. Is that a big issue, that their life is out of control, so this is one way of grasping it?
I mean, a lot of children can be very rigid about their thought processes, but in the children I see, I don't think it's really about control per se. But so the first step is to make food a comfortable thing to enjoy. So to create a positive experience around food, that's where you start. And that's, you start by making sure that they don't have constipation, so that when they eat, it doesn't hurt. Addressing the sensory issues. But also, the parents have to provide foods that are within the child's capabilities as well. So this all creates a more positive atmosphere around food. If you have a fussy eater, 5-year-old fussy eater, and you give them a pork chop, they can't eat it. They've never eaten real meat in their life. They don't know how to chew it. They don't just, it's like, wow. If you give them a pork meatball, then they have a chance of success. So you have to make sure that you're only offering your child foods, you know, as an initial step, you're only offering the child foods that they can actually achieve and they can actually like eat. And then once you've kind of got the gut sorted out and they're a bit more comfortable, then you have to get them to tolerate new foods on their plate. Because what has probably happened over the years is that parents have just taken all the foods away. And now they might be having Greek salad with lamb kebabs, but their child's eating chicken nuggets and chips. And, you know, avoidance feeds anxiety. So if you've taken away the Greek salad and the lamb kebabs, you're actually saying to the child, you're right, you should be anxious about this food because this food is scary. So you just stick to your chicken nuggets and chips.
All right.
Which is why one of my pet hates, it's more than a pet hate, it's a monster hate, is when people refer to safe foods. I'll give my child their safe foods. So you're absolutely telling that child that these are his safe foods. And the other foods else are dangerous.
Yeah.
You need to be scared of these foods if they will kill you. So you never like safe, remove, unless it's you're talking about allergies or a food safety issue with a food. Yeah. You don't talk about safe foods.
Yeah, right. That's really important. That's great.
Yeah.
Tell us more about how that looks, though, because often these parents come to you, they've already entrenched in a behavior. It's now your job, unfortunately, to change that behavior, to redirect that behavior to a more healthy approach to food. How do you break down those barriers in a child who's scared?
Well, exposure. I mean, as well as addressing the gut stuff, the deficiencies, all those underlying drivers, it's about exposure in a graded way. So, you know, not letting your child opt out of helping in the kitchen because they don't eat those foods. So one piece of homework that a lot of kids will get is that they have to make the salad for their parents every evening. They don't have to eat the salad. There's absolutely no suggestion. Nobody is saying, just take a lick, just a bite, just a little bit. There's none of that. It's literally, you need to help with dinner, make me a salad. And I give people these really great kid-friendly knives. So they're getting exposed, they're getting comfortable with the foods, but there's no pressure. Because if you pressure an anxious kid to eat, there is no chance, you've lost it.
Got it. So it's pure exposure, it's desensitization.
So, and that can be a very traumatic experience for a child that's actually, because children before the age of 3 children who are not eating, it's not because of anxiety, because they don't have that kind of forward what if thoughts about food. So if they're under three, it's because, you know, they can't chew or they can't sit up straight or they've got sensory issues. But then it develops into anxiety at sort of three, four, five. And one of the reasons why it can develop into anxiety is because they've been force-fed or they've been starved. So even to this day, a lot of people will say, just don't give them anything else to eat and they'll eat eventually. So that sort of traumatic experience can trigger anxiety. But then parents, you know, you don't want parents to get confused. When I'm saying don't pressure them, a lot of people think, oh, we don't need to worry about it. We just don't worry about it. Like, so that's not what I'm saying. But pressure is not the way to go. You do eat as a family. You get them to prepare the food. You get them to serve everybody else at the table. You know, you sit down, you enjoy the meal. It's all about, you know, talking about your day. Just all those things that are going to encourage your child to eat without saying, now you have to eat some and you have to finish your plate.
Right. One of the important aspects I'm picking up from you is something that Amanda Archibald spoke recently at the Cell Logic Symposium, and it's got to do with conviviality. I loved this word when she was talking about it, conviviality, the thing that we've lost, that social interaction of meal times. And granted that it's hard in this day and age, and certainly coming into this economic issue period that we're going through now in 2023, heading into 2024, and that is that parents are under such stress. You know, a lot of them are commuting. I get the issues of time. But if you can set aside a time that where a meal is a social coming together environment rather than here's your meal, go off into your bedroom and play your, you know, your shoot 'em up game or whatever, you must eat. So how do you then, if a child has their own set behaviors of no, that's my normality, how do you bring them together? What's the invitation to stop making that a stressful exposure?
So step one is just getting them to the table, eating their own food and nothing else. So yes, they'll be eating their chicken nuggets and chips when everybody else is eating the Greek salad and the lamb kebabs, but at least they're at the table. So you just really do a very, very graded approach. But it is absolutely fundamental for your child's eating that they eat with you as a family, and it reduces mental health issues. Just eating as a family will reduce the chance of your teenager having a mental health issue. Yeah. It improves your child's vocabulary, so they'll do better at school and be better able to talk. And it's the time in the day when you bond as a family, because we all know kids grow up very, very, very quickly, and you know it's a very small time commitment in your day to just sit down with your kids and eat dinner and let them talk about their day and what happened.
So we're changing, you know, family behaviors that are, as I said, already entrenched. What I'm getting is that you're really changing. It's kind of like training a dog. You train the owner.
Yeah.
So you're training the parents first to say, stop whatever you're doing because it's not working. That's why you're here.
Yeah.
Let's approach it from a different angle. How much, therefore, do you have to spend in retraining and making sure that the lessons are cemented in the parent so that they can get that through to the child?
Yeah. So, I mean, there was one parent that I spoke to one time and I said, right, first thing we need to do is we need to do family mealtime. There was like a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. I said, right, we need to do family mealtimes. I said, I can't. And I said, well, what about Sunday? No, that's running. What about Monday? I'm at work. And then blah, blah, blah. Tuesday, no, that's soccer training. Wednesday, no, that's swimming. And then I have this. What about third? No. So there was not one mealtime, either lunch, dinner, or breakfast in the week that she could commit to eating with her children. And so I said to her, I'm sorry, I just can't help you, because if you can't commit one mealtime a week, then there's nothing. I can't do anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's about, I guess, helping people get results quickly to motivate them that these things will happen.
Yeah.
And doing family meals and family style serving is a good way to get some quick wins, which then, I guess, it just makes them believe that the process will work if they stick with it.
I totally get you that sometimes you have to let the patient go on their journey.
Yeah.
They're not ready for it yet. But as long as you stick to your guns to know what works, yeah. you say, look, this is what you need to do. There will always be people who are not ready. There will always be people who can't or won't commit to a sort of a patient practitioner contract. That must be really frustrating for you, though.
There's been very few people like that. That person stands out. She was like, no, can't do it. No.
Okay, so let's move forward on to results. What sort of time, I get another piece of string question, sorry, forgive me, but what sort of time are you expecting that you'll get changes in behavior and anxiety related to food?
So I think best way is probably to talk about an example. So it was a 10-year-old girl who came to me with crippling anxiety, like they were on the point of medication, and she'd had anxiety for quite a few years at this stage. So we did a stool test, and she had Giardia, she had enterohemorrhagic E. coli, she had really high Morganella, which is a histamine liberator. It showed she had a reaction to gluten, she had a leaky gut. And you know, when she came to me, the primary presenting problem was the anxiety, but she also did have tummy pain and constipation. So she did have some indications that there was something going on with her gut. So we did the stool test, we got the results, we treated them. By her third appointment, so you know, 2-3 months later, the anxiety was no longer a problem. So if you can identify what the issue is and address it, then you can get really good results. But when you know, a lot of people are very concerned from a financial point of view about asking parents to do testing because testing is very expensive. But when you don't do the testing, you will spend a lot more time and money trying to figure out what's going on rather than just getting the data at the very start of the process and addressing it. So yeah, if you can find the reason, then you can get great results really quickly.
Two-pronged question. Do you always do a pre-treatment and a treatment test so that you know that you're eliciting a change in whatever heavy metals? And talking about that patient there with enterohemorrhagic E. coli, I get the issues with antibiotics upsetting the normal microbiota, but are there cases where you think that antibiotics are warranted in controlling an infection to at least settle something down? We've seen this, for instance, sometimes useful in allergies, for instance.
No.
Dang.
Oh, I have a personal experience with enterohemorrhagic E. coli, 0157H7 myself. And I know from my research back then that giving antibiotics for that will actually lyse the bacteria and release toxins.
Ooh.
So for that specific case, definitely not antibiotics. I've never sent a child to get antibiotics on the basis of a stool test.
So that goes back to what Mike Ash saliently said at a conference many years ago, and he said terrain is everything. You've
Absolutely.
Got to build the terrain. Gotcha.
Absolutely.
So actually, you're pulling me up here on something that I used to say to people, stop the kill mentality. Change the terrain and you'll find that the body can cope with at least most things.
Yeah, I mean, you do need to kill like Giardia, but you do it with some nice gentle herbs.
So we're going to be talking mainly about this in our next podcast, but I think it's warranted that we explore a few of these now, at least in a general way. So talking about parasites, how safe are the anti-parasitic herbs that we have, you know, the oregano oil and things like that? And where do you use things like Saccharomyces boulardii or colostrum or the new IgG serum that's out here, serum IgG. How often do you use these products as antimicrobials?
So something like wormwood, I would rarely use with a child just because of the taste more so.
Yeah.
So like with Giardia, I use a herbal formula, but it's still a very gentle herbal formula. I think there's propolis in it and thyme and echinacea. So again, more about building up the child's immune system to deal with these things. And I try not to use a kill, kill, kill approach. So I wouldn't use, like, maybe in very, very rare circumstances, I would use oil of oregano, but generally, no, a lot more prebiotics, probiotics, a lot more pomegranate, those sorts of things. And yeah, the new IgG product, I think I've used it a few times. It's very interesting.
I must say, like, I'm a big fan of colostrum, but I do concede that there's some people that react to it. However, my experience has been overwhelmingly positive with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I will definitely use that to calm things down in the very first instance.
Yeah. And of course, Secretory IgA with regards to Saccharomyces boulardii. But do you employ high doses of probiotics, or do you tend to go in really gently?
It just depends on what else is going on. But with children, I will give the adult dose of a probiotic. Like, I won't scale it down. So if the, you know, if the adult dose is two capsules of probiotic, I'll give two capsules of the probiotic. And I rarely have any, you know, die-off issues or anything in doing that.
What about the introduction of prebiotics? Do you find that, for instance, with somebody with constipation and then you put in a whole whack of prebiotics, you're going to get this whole turmoil happening in your guts and there's going to be a lot of wind, a lot of pain before the constipation is eased? Do you tend to employ things like lactulose to get things moving along at all? Tell me how you...
I love lactulose because kids love it. So, you know, the best supplement is the one that your kids will take. So I use lactulose in a lot of kids, primarily because it's just so easy to get into them. And I will titrate it up. So I'll start like with 1 mil and then just, but I'll titrate it up quickly, like over the course of a couple of weeks to get them to the dose. And I used a lot of GOS and PHGG as well.
Yeah.
So I find PHGG for constipated kids is just, it's amazing. Like, that's kind of my favorite thing to get constipated kids going. And yeah, I'll start it and build it up gradually, and it's usually fine. There's the very, very occasional child who will get more constipated on it, but it's kind of 1 in 100.
And what about the actual delivery of the prebiotics, because we're talking about a dose here? Mixing it into food when you've got a restrictive diet, how does that work? How does that look?
A lot of parents put it in their kid's water bottle, so they just put it in their water,
right?
So, I mean, with prebiotics, you're better to get it in one dose. So to take the 3 grams or whatever at one go. But some parents will put it over like the course of a morning. So they'll put it in their child's water and they'll drink it over the course of a morning. It's very easy to get prebiotics into kids in their yogurt, in their milk.
And herbs that you discussed, do you tend to favor alcoholic extracts or glycitrate?
So I am moving over to glycitrates. Now, so I'm kind of starting to transition over to glycitrates, but I use both with kids. And because kids are so used to taking Panadol in a syringe, unfortunately, they're just, or antibiotics in a syringe, it's kind of, it's a normal thing for them to do, to take their banana flavored syrup.
Yeah.
So I just get the parents to mix the herbs with like mango nectar or something and squirt it into their mouth, and it's amazingly easy for even the fussiest of eaters to take their herbs in that way.
You raise a really good point there, is that you've got to make the medicine easy to take. You know, a teaspoon of sugar makes the medicine go down, sort of thing, Mary Poppins. But there's no point having a lovely medicine that, because of its taste, is just going to be refused by many children. So make it, if you have to acquiesce to, you know, a sugary delivery system, do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And parents would be like, juice? Really? I'm going, your child's eating chicken nuggets and chips and rice crackers. I don't think a bit of juice is going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. So a bit of juice. And the other thing that's great is Yakult. So, you know, a lot of people would say, oh, Yakult full of sugar. It's this size. And you can actually, there's good evidence for the strains. Yeah. Kids love it. And you can pop an extra bit of probiotic into it as well in there. Skullet, it's done.
Lisa, there's so many things that we're going to learn from you in part two, and we're going to really drill down and get as much information as we can out of you. But obviously there's so much expertise that you've gotten over a career. I mean, gosh, you need to write a course, please. One quick question, microbial diversity. If we're giving a probiotic, we want to enhance microbial diversity. The best way to get that is food. And you sort of gave us an inkling of that time expectancy to change, if you like. But what about long-term benefits that you see? Do you ever revisit kids like 1 year, 2 year, 3 years later?
And redo the stool test or just...
Yeah, or just revisit their symptomatology.
And quite often I'm working with these kids for a year.
Gotcha.
Or more. That's how long it will take to get them from eating two foods to get them to eating like 40 foods. It can take a year or two. So I'll be with them for the long term. So I'll see the changes in them over that time and just see them just get happier, more engaged. Just all the stuff that you would expect to happen over that time frame. That's why they keep coming back to me. I mean, they wouldn't keep coming to see me for a year if they weren't getting progress, but you know, progress is individual. So a child that came to me with ARFID and ate five foods, so it had to be, you know, this toast, and it had to be, you know, this specific rice cracker, and it had to be, you know, this specific brand of chicken nuggets from this. So she was eating five foods. Now she eats 40, 50 foods, but she's still not eating any fruit and vegetables. So you could look at that and say, well, that's a failure. But the parents are delighted because instead of them eating like the same foods, breakfast, lunch, dinner, day after day after day, they'll eat all the rice crackers and they'll eat all the chicken nuggets. And, you know, she'll eat nuts and seeds now. She still won't eat fruits and vegetables, but she'll eat nuts and seeds. So,
yeah,
you know,
progress. Well, I see that as a win. I'm sorry.
Exactly. But definitely, you know, they went to the GP and the GP looked at I'd written out the list of the foods that the child now eats, gone, but there's no fruits or vegetables. It's like, yes, but she was eating this amount of foods and now she's eating this amount of foods happily.
Yeah.
So, you know, in another year, it'll be this length of foods. And that's, you know, what's the alternative? Make slow progress or make no progress? That's
right. What a great point to end on. Lisa, thank you so much. Like, I've podcasted with you a couple of times and each time I'm learning something new. There's obviously a wealth in that engineering brain of yours. What I love is that you, how methodical you are and how calm you are in your approach. It's wonderful to see, and it's obvious the care that you have for kids, but on an objective basis. Absolutely wonderful to interview you, and I look forward to part two. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Andrew.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Remember, you will put up the show notes in the podcast and also on natmedpartners.com.au. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Andrew Whitfield-Cook.